Chapter 11, Divide and Rule. They divided both to conquer each, Frederick Douglass. One day when I was 5 years old, I saw a black man walking down the street. Delighted, I cried, "There's a chocolate man," and ran to get a closer look. 14 years later, while working as a receptionist, my boss handed me a stack of job applications and instructed me to discard forms submitted by black applicants. When I asked why, he replied, "The shippers don't want to work with those people." These two stories demonstrate opposite reactions to human differences. One is delight and curiosity, the other is fear and hate. In order to divide and rule, the capitalist class promotes fear and hate. Death by a thousand cuts. Capitalism splinters humanity. The first cut is the deepest. The horizontal divide between the many who labor and the few who confiscate the fruits of labor sees the surplus. This class division traverses the globe to create an international ruling class, an international working class, and a buffer class in the middle. In every nation, a minority ruling class dominates a majority working class. Even the poorest nations have their elites. In 2005, Latin America had 300,000 millionaires with combined assets of more than $4 trillion U.S. dollars. Africa had 100,000 millionaires worth a total of $800 billion U.S. dollars. Hundreds of vertical cuts slice humanity into nations that compete economically and militarily, compete or die. There is no such thing as a community of nations or an international community. Stronger nations exploit weaker ones using methods that range from unfair trade policies to direct military occupation. Within each nation, the class-divided population is chopped vertically into multiple segments based on race, sex, language, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, politics, age, geographic location, state of health, and practically any other characteristic you can think of. Each segment retains the horizontal class divisions. For example, in all nations, the majority of black people are working class, some are middle class, and a tiny few inhabit the ruling class. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in the U.S. In order to rule, the capitalist class portrays all these divisions as fixed and indisputable. Class inequality is explained as the superiority of the few and the inferiority of the many, the cream that rises to the top, and the survival of the fittest, while racism, sexism, xenophobia, and homophobia are declared to be instinctual. None of this is true. Throughout history, human behavior, values, and social structures have been changed repeatedly. The truth is that when two classes have opposing interests, the smaller one can rule only by dividing the larger one. This chapter examines some of the divisions that sustain the capitalist order. How different are we? Humanity is one species that capitalism has fragmented into many different races and nations, even though our similarities far outweigh our differences. Compare any two people in the world, and you will find that 99.8% of their genetic material is identical, and only 0.2% is different. People are so similar because our species has one origin, Africa. According to geneticist Svante Paabo, from a genetic perspective, all humans are Africans, either residing in Africa or in recent exile. As people migrated from the motherland, isolated groups developed minor physical variations. Anthropologist James Shreve notes that skin and eye color, the shape of eyes, nose, and mouth, and the color, texture, and distribution of hair are biological variations that do vary from region to region, but they do so independently, not in packaged sets. Most people who live in Asia have skin folds on their eyes, as do the Bushmen of South Africa. Black-skinned people can have kinky hair and poker straight hair. There are black people with thin lips and narrow noses, and white people with full lips and broad noses. As more people migrate throughout the world, even these regional variations are disappearing. The Human Genome Project discovered that, quote, racial differences make up only 0.01% of the body's genes. These differences are so superficial that someone who looks very different from you and lives on the other side of the world could be a better organ donor for you than someone who resembles you and lives on your street. The American Anthropological Association concludes, quote, human populations are not unambiguous, clearly demarcated, biologically distinct groups. Throughout history, whenever different groups have come into contact, they have interbred. Any attempt to establish lines of division among biological populations is both arbitrary and subjective, close quote. The biological concept of race has no scientific basis. However, it does serve a political purpose, to divide people by maximizing their differences and minimizing their similarities. Racist assumptions are deeply embedded in the English language. The designations black and white divide people by skin color and exaggerate that difference. In fact, white people are not really white. They are various shades of beige. This can be demonstrated by holding a sheet of white paper against the skin. Black people are not really black. They are various shades of brown, including beige. It would be more color accurate to use the labels brown and beige. Using the terms black and white implies polar opposites, when all human beings are actually shades of the same color. Indicate that black and white are political labels, not colors. I have capitalized them throughout the text, except in quotations that appear as originally written. How natural is the tendency to classify people by skin color? A clever two-part experiment set out to answer this question. In the first part of the experiment, volunteers were shown photographs of individuals that were matched with specific sentences. The sentences were shown out of order, and the volunteers had to reunite each sentence with a photograph of the person it was originally paired with. The volunteers tended to connect sentences with individuals based on the color of their skin. In the second part of the experiment, the individuals and their matching sentences were grouped in two color-coded teams, one wearing gray shirts and one wearing yellow shirts. Both teams contained black and white members. This time, volunteers matched the sentences to their owners by shirt color more than by skin color. The researchers concluded that less than 4 minutes of exposure to an alternate social world was enough to deflate the tendency to categorize by race, close quote. Racial categories are so artificial that they need constant reinforcing to be maintained. The history of racism in America reveals how important racial divisions are to capitalism. Slave Republic. The United States of America was founded on the destruction of Aboriginal peoples through ethnic cleansing, forcing them onto reservations, biological warfare, distributing blankets contaminated with disease, and outright genocide to steal their land. The wholesale massacre of men, women, and children was supported by racist propaganda portraying them as subhuman. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. Having seized control of the land, large landowners needed people to work it. Free laborers kept leaving the plantations to establish their own farms, so indentured servants, aboriginals, and convicts were pressed into service. People were literally kidnapped off the streets of England to work in America. Still, the demand for labor outstripped the supply. The solution was slavery. An unlimited number of slaves could be captured from Africa and forced to work with no hope of a better life. The business of kidnapping poor whites shifted to the even more lucrative business of kidnapping African blacks. In Capitalism and Slavery, Eric Williams describes how, quote, kidnapping in Africa encountered no such difficulties as were encountered in England. Captains and ships had the experience of the one trade to guide them in the other. Bristol, the center of the servant trade, became one of the centers of the slave trade. Capital accumulated from one financed the other. White servitude was a historic base upon which Negro slavery was constructed, close quote. In the People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn notes that, quote, Africa lost 50 million human beings to death and slavery in those centuries we call the beginnings of modern Western civilization, quote. Black slavery financed the Industrial Revolution in England and built the fortunes of America's ruling families. Being essential to the economy, the slave system was enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Racism. Slavery was not born of racism. Rather, racism was the consequence of slavery. Eric Williams. Racism is the practice of discriminating against a group of people and the beliefs that justify that practice. The feudal ruling class had no need for a theory of racial difference. Feudal inequality was justified as God's will, the divine right of kings. Being rooted in science and industry, the capitalist class needed a secular explanation, so it attributed inequality to biology. However, a specific theory of racial inferiority did not develop until the, quote, land of the free needed to justify black slavery. According to historian Barbara J. Fields, quote, it was the prevalence of freedom rather than the fact of slavery that created American racism. English people might find Africans and their descendants to be heathen in religion, outlandish in nationality, and weird in appearance. But that did not become an ideology of racial inferiority until one further ingredient became part of the mixture, and that was the incorporation of Africans and their descendants into a society in which they lacked the rights that others not only took for granted, but claimed as a matter of self-evident natural law, close quote. In 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that slaves were property, not people, and that, quote, the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit, close quote. The American Civil War did not begin as a war against slavery. On the contrary, Northern armies were instructed to return fleeing slaves to their masters. Frederick Douglass observed that, quote, the South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North fighting to keep it in the Union, close quote. President Lincoln wrote, quote, my paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that, close quote. In 1862, Lincoln threatened to free the slaves of the... if the South did not surrender. As an added incentive, he promised that states pledging allegiance to the Union could continue using slaves. A year later, the Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves only in states that remained hostile to the Union. However, the need to defeat the South forced Lincoln to abolish slavery altogether. After the Civil War, laws were passed to prohibit racial discrimination and grant black people the right to vote, to own land, and to hold public office. Hungry for cheap labor, Southern plantation owners organized the Ku Klux Klan and other vigilante groups to beat, burn, lynch, and terrorize blacks into accepting conditions that were not much better than slavery. In this matter, Northern industrialists allied with Southern landowners. In 1883, the Supreme Court nullified the Civil Rights Act of 1875. 13 years later, it established legal segregation by ruling that blacks and whites could be, quote, separate but equal. The Smithsonian Institute and the American Association for the Advancement of Science gave credibility to segregation legislation by reviving the claim that blacks were subhuman. More than 400 Jim Crow laws, constitutional amendments and city ordinances made it a crime for blacks to mingle with whites in hotels, hospitals, restaurants, washrooms, marriage, military service, and even in cemeteries. If it were natural for people to stick with their own kind, such measures would have been unnecessary. The civil rights movement of the mid-20th century abolished legal segregation. However, actual or de facto segregation continues in employment, housing, education, medicine, banking, sports, prisons, the military, virtually every aspect of American life. Racism persists because it is necessary to divide the working class. Capitalism could not survive the challenge of a unified majority. By pitting black and white workers against each other, employers can control both groups. Racism is so important to capitalism that it permeates all classes and all social institutions. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Medical racism. The American medical system is deeply racist. Medical statistics are collected primarily on the basis of race and rarely on the basis of social class, occupation, income level, or access to medical care, even though these factors have the greatest impact on health. In Backdoor to Eugenics, Troy Duster warns that using racial categories to measure infant death rates, disease rates, and life expectancy supports the myth of racial inferiority. By emphasizing race, medicine transforms social problems into biological defects. Medical research typically compares whites, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians. Where there is no scientific way to decide who fits into which group or how to distinguish between these groups, the 1890 census established the one-drop rule that decreed that an individual with one black ancestor was considered black even if that person had white skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. Later on, people were categorized by appearance. Beginning with the 2000 census, Americans could check more than one of six races, including some other race, to produce a total of 63 combinations of race and a total of 126 possible categories or combinations of race and ethnicity. Migration and intermarriage make it so difficult to decide one's racial group that many people change their racial category with each survey. Business has never let science interfere with profit. Linking illness with race creates a market for race-specific drugs. Researcher Jonathan Kahn describes how a combination drug named Bidil was rejected by the FDA for treatment of heart failure and subsequently reinvented as a specific treatment for blacks. In 2002, Bidil was granted the first U.S. patent for a race-specific drug. In granting this patent, the federal government declared African Americans to be a distinct biological group. There is no evidence that Bidil will help black people. The drug trial enrolled only black subjects, so no one knows if Bidil is more beneficial for blacks and whites. Furthermore, the study assumed that if some blacks responded well to Bidil, then all blacks will. We come back to the question of who is black. Because there is no biological way to differentiate between the races, subjects in the Bidil study were categorized as black if they said they were black. Bad science can be good economics. If Bidil had been approved for general use, its patent would have expired in 2007. When Bidil was approved as a race-specific drug, its patent was extended to 2020. There are some biological differences in how people metabolize drugs. However, these differences do not correspond to skin color. An analysis of 15 studies that compared black and white reactions to blood pressure-lowering drugs found that the difference between whites and blacks was much smaller than the variations within each color group. Another study compared 23 drug-metabolizing genes among 354 people representing 8 classically defined races. The genes fell into 4 groupings that did not match any of the race categories. The researchers concluded, there is no clear link between skin pigment and drug metabolism genes. Skin pigment is a lousy surrogate for drug metabolism status, or most any aspect of human physiology. But never mind the facts, the federal government is determined to link race and health. The Department of Health and Human Services funded a study to determine the effect of race on calcium metabolism. One researcher announced that, quote, while we found a racial difference in calcium retention in adolescents, we also confirmed that blacks retain more sodium on a high-salt diet than whites. This proves that salt is processed differently in the races, close quote. This sweeping conclusion was based on a study of 22 African American girls and 13 Caucasian girls. The results of this study were considered to be valid because the girls' diets were strictly monitored. However, no one revealed how the racial categories were determined. This study was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and its conclusion, calcium retention is significantly greater in black girls than in white girls, was headlined by the media. People who are identified as black do suffer more medical problems, not because of different biology, but because they live in a racist society. Inequality creates disease, and medical problems multiply as one moves down the social ladder. While the overall U.S. poverty rate is 12%, 24% of American blacks are poor. Black unemployment is double the rate of white unemployment, and the median income for black households is almost 40% less than for white households. Black babies die at more than double the rate for white babies. Black women are almost 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes. Black people as a whole are more likely to die of heart disease, stroke, cancer, and diabetes than white people of the same age. Despite their greater need, black people get second-rate medical care. Studies show that black patients with congestive heart failure and pneumonia receive inferior medical treatment. Black people with early-stage lung cancer are less likely to have surgery and are more likely to die as a result. Blacks are more likely to be misdiagnosed as schizophrenic and to be institutionalized for mental illness. The only medical procedure that blacks receive more than any other group is limb amputation as a result of neglected health problems. Because of racism, the average life expectancy of black Americans is 6 years shorter than that of white Americans. Racism causes an estimated 84,000 additional deaths in the United States every year, more than the equivalent of a Hurricane Katrina every week. The editor of the Harvard School of Public Health's Minority Health Today declares, quote, "This is nothing short of a national medical emergency. When are we going to stop talking about it and start doing something about it?" Close quote. The problem is what to do. Race-based medical research and race-specific treatments fail to address the social conditions that kill black and white people. All blacks experience special oppression, but that doesn't mean that all whites are doing fine. Most poor people in America are white. Most people without medical insurance are white. And most homeless people are white. And most people on welfare are white. In deprived areas where more black babies die, more white babies also die. The medical focus on skin color avoids the political issue of why so many people, black and white, live and work in harmful social conditions. The best way to improve the health of black people is to end the deprivation that makes people sick regardless of their skin color. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Imperial racism. Empires rule by dividing the populations they conquer. A many times conquered people, Africa knows the terrible cost of divide and rule. In Rwanda, in the spring of 1994, as many as 1 million people were hacked, shot, strangled, clubbed, and burned to death. The American media attributed the massacres to age-old tribal feuding. In fact, imperial powers sowed the seeds of this slaughter. Before Germany and Belgium dominated Rwanda, there were three occupational groups. The Hutu were farmers, the Tutsi raised cattle, and the Twa were hunter-gatherers. These were not class divisions. One could be a poor Tutsi or a rich Hutu. All spoke the same language, intermarriage was common, and a person could shift from one group to another simply by changing occupation. The colonial period that began in the 1890s transformed Rwanda's occupational groupings into racial divisions. Because they looked the same and spoke the same language, people were forced to carry identity cards designating them as Tutsi or Hutu, and movement between the groups became more difficult. The Belgians praised the Tutsi as racially superior and gave them privileges in the colonial hierarchy, even though the majority of Tutsi remained poor. The racialization of consciousness affected everybody, and even the small Tutsi, who did not benefit from the system in any way, started to believe they were indeed a superior race and that under the same rags as their Hutu neighbors wore, a finer heart was beating. The Hutu, deprived of all political power and exploited by both the whites and the Tutsi, began to hate all Tutsi, even those who were just as poor as they. When the Tutsi elite decided to run Rwanda independent of Belgian control, the Belgians backed a Hutu rebellion to oust the Tutsi from power. Civil conflict intensified as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund imposed economic shock therapy that impoverished the country. As Rwanda slid into bankruptcy, it disintegrated into warring factions. Weapons from France, Egypt, and South Africa poured into the country. Disregarding warnings of impending massacres, the United Nations pulled most of its troops from Rwanda. This move was viewed as a green light to escalate the slaughter. The tragedy of Rwanda has been and continues to be replayed throughout Africa and the world. To control India, the British Empire played Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh against each other. To control Iraq, the U.S. is playing Shiite Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Kurds against one another. Imperial conquest has divided and redivided the Balkans. After World War II, Yugoslavia established a fairly integrated society. In the 1980s, the economy began to sink under the burden of international debt. Factional leaders staked out their territory and provoked a civil war. The greater the social cohesion, the more terror is needed to shatter those bonds. The most atrocious interpersonal violence was used to turn friends, family, and neighbors against each other so decisively that no reconciliation seemed possible. Like vultures, other nations armed whichever side they thought would position them most favorably. The United States emerged as the primary beneficiary of the war, obtaining military bases in territory previously controlled by the Soviet Union. The former Yugoslavia remains divided under military occupation. Duplicity is basic to divide and rule. Imperial powers befriend and betray based on their own interests, regardless of the harm they cause. During the Cold War, the U.S. armed and trained Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamic fundamentalists to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, and to promote U.S. interests in the Middle East. These former friends are now enemies. During the civil war in Yugoslavia, the U.S. backed the Muslims, claiming they were the underdogs. Muslims later became villains when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. During the 1980s, the U.S. backed and armed both sides of the Iran-Iraq war. Now both countries stand in the way of America's plans to control the Middle East. When today's allies are tomorrow's enemies, the result is war without end. Nations divide. It seems as if the world has always been divided into nations. In fact, the nation-state is a recent invention of capitalism. People in feudal societies lived and worked in a multitude of small fiefdoms, each ruled by wealthy families, most having their own language and customs. As capitalism developed, this patchwork of independent economies presented a barrier to trade and commerce. The capitalist revolutions of the 18th century began to consolidate this hodgepodge into the system of nation-states we know today. As the global economy becomes more international, you would think that capitalism would welcome more open national borders or no borders at all. However, competition compels capitalists to rely on the financial, political, and military support of their home states. Corporate America dominates the world economically because the American state dominates the world militarily. To improve their economic clout, nations have banded together in formal and informal trade blocs like the European Union, Mercosur, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Venezuela, and the North American Free Trade Agreement, United States, Canada, and Mexico. These blocs do not reduce competition, they take it to a higher level. As long as capitalism exists, the economic pressure to integrate the world economy will strain against the national divisions that are necessary for capitalist competition. Like a volcano building up steam, these pressures periodically erupt in wars that redraw national boundaries. The capitalist class compares the nation to a family, with itself in the role of parent. However, this is a false comparison. Most families are composed of people from the same social class, while nations are composed of people from antagonistic classes. When President Bush says, "You're either with us or against us," he uses "us" to mean the nation as a whole, when he actually means me and my class. The myth of nation as family seduces workers into supporting the policies of the capitalist class as if they were good for everyone. Like sports teams, nations unite and divide. Sports fans are typically loyal to their own teams and hostile to competing teams. Flag waving is practiced in sports and reaches a frenzy in times of war. Nationalism unites the people in one country by dividing them from the people in other countries. Concepts like nation and national identity assume that people inside a set of borders share a common culture and common values that other people do not share. This is fiction. People living in the same apartment building don't share the same beliefs and practices, let alone nations of millions. Because national divisions are necessary for capitalist competition, each capitalist class tries to convince its working class that our nation is the best. By fostering emotional bonds between capitalists and workers, patriotism divides and weakens the working class. Border wars. Patriotism and nationalism are forms of racism. The belief that the differences between people on either side of a border are more important than their common interests. These differences are as artificial as the borders themselves, which move back and forth in response to political conflict and territorial conquest. We didn't cross the border crossed us. Any map more than 10 years old is already out of date. The capitalist class polices national boundaries to separate us and them, and supposedly to protect us from them, to exaggerate the fear of outsiders. Foreigners and immigrants are called aliens, a term also used to describe non-humans from outer space. This is the kind of paranoia displayed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Quote, "We believe it is a very serious vulnerability when there are illegal aliens working at Air Force bases, nuclear power plants, chemical plants, and airports. They have access to some of the most sensitive work sites in the U.S. Our job is to take actions to immediately remove them from positions where they can do harm." Close quote. The racist assumption that immigrants are dangerous, even terrorists, has created a major conflict inside the United States. Rich nations need immigrants because their birth rates are too low to supply the demand for labor. The National Research Council calculates that immigration results in a net gain to the U.S. economy of $10 billion a year. Instead of appreciating immigrants for their contributions, the state has declared war on them. A 2003 Supreme Court ruling allows Congress to pass laws against immigrants that would violate the Constitution if they were applied to citizens. Homeland Security has a plan called Endgame to apprehend, incarcerate, and deport all, quote, removable aliens from the U.S. by 2012. However, the economy would be crippled if this goal were actually achieved. The capitalist class does not want to remove all immigrants. It wants a fearful, disposable, low-wage workforce with no legal rights. So the state attacks immigrants and ignores those who hire them. To survive, workers must move to where there are jobs. The 1994 Free Trade Agreement between the U.S. and Mexico devastated the Mexican economy and forced Mexican workers to seek jobs in the U.S. That same year, the Clinton administration launched Operation Gatekeeper to make it harder for Mexican workers to enter the U.S. By 2006, the U.S. Border Patrol had a $1.6 billion budget to turn the boundary between U.S. and Mexico into a war zone. Anti-immigrant attacks coming from the top of society emboldened the far right, and vigilante border patrols formed, bolstered by white supremacist groups like the Ku Klux Klan. Since 1994, more than 4,000 migrant workers have been killed trying to cross the border, and this number continues to rise. The capitalist class profits from the oppression of immigrants. Workers without rights can be paid less or not at all, and deported when they complain or try to organize unions. Promoting competition between native-born and foreign-born workers makes it easier to exploit both groups and drive down wages in a race to the bottom. Immigrants also make convenient scapegoats for social problems like crime, unemployment, and falling living standards. What are the facts? In terms of crime, Harvard sociologists found first-generation immigrants to be 45% less likely to commit violence than third-generation Americans. They concluded that increased immigration in the 1990s could explain why the murder rate during that decade dropped to levels not seen since the 1960s. Immigrants do not cause unemployment. Areas with higher immigration offer more job opportunities. Immigrants increase the demand for goods and services, and many immigrants start businesses that provide jobs. Nor do immigrants cause wages to fall. The capitalist class is responsible for keeping the minimum wage at $5.15 an hour while the cost of living rises. 12 million undocumented workers cannot be held responsible for the existence of 40 million low-wage jobs. On the contrary, immigrant workers have launched union organizing drives that benefit all workers. Lies about immigrants are used to divide workers and prevent a revival of the labor movement. Many people think that immigrants use more public services than they pay for in taxes, when the opposite is true. Most undocumented immigrants work for established companies and pay taxes just like other workers. Undocumented immigrants pay about $7 billion more into Social Security than they get back, and $1.5 billion more into Medicare than they receive in services. Over a lifetime, each immigrant pays an average of $80,000 more in taxes than he or she will ever use in government services. The ruling class tries to convince those who have little that they will have less if others have rights. Experience shows that the opposite is true. In 1994, half the black voters in California, endorsed an anti-immigrant measure that denied undocumented workers basic social services like welfare and emergency medical care. Kianga Yamada Taylor points out, quote, "Most of the African Americans thought that voting yes on Proposition 187 would improve their own economic status, operating from the assumption that Latino immigrants were taking limited resources away from poor and working-class blacks. Instead, Proposition 187 helped to foster an environment of racism and scapegoating that no doubt contributed to the passing of an anti-affirmative action referendum 2 years later." Close quote. In late 2005, the House passed a bill making it a felony to be an undocumented immigrant or to assist one. There are an estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. This measure would have criminalized all of them and all who helped them. Family, friends, neighbors, clergy, social workers, medical workers, and lawyers. In response to this outrageous attack, millions of people poured into the streets to demand rights for immigrants. Repeated nationwide demonstrations emptied schools and closed workplaces. There were general strikes in Chicago and Los Angeles. Chanting, "We are America and no human being is illegal," the working class rose up and punched the ruling class in the face. Reeling from this blow, both the House and the Senate failed to pass their anti-immigrant bills before the 2006 summer recess. The Great American Boycott reclaimed the mass strike as a legitimate weapon of protest. The ruling class retaliated with anti-immigrant raids and the deployment of thousands of National Guards on the border. However, there is no going back. The American working class is multinational. As long as goods and services can cross borders freely, then the workers who create those goods and services will want the same right. In the 19th century, Karl Marx concluded that working people have no nation because all nations are anti-worker. Employers can shift production to countries where wages are lower because borders prevent workers from going where wages are higher. Capital can flow freely across borders in search of profits because borders block workers from uniting to raise their living standards. A worker's nationality is like a dog tag that specifies which ruling class has the right to take what the worker creates and to make the worker fight its wars. Capitalism forces workers to choose. Be loyal to your nation and betray your class, or be loyal to your class and betray your nation. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Who is the enemy? All capitalist wars require a parallel war at home against those who resemble the enemy. In order for England to dominate Ireland, it must promote discrimination against the Irish to prevent unity between English and Irish workers. For the United States to dominate Latin America, it must promote discrimination against Hispanics to prevent unity between American and Latin American workers. During the U.S. war against Japan, more than 110,000 Japanese Americans were forced into internment camps, and their homes and property were confiscated. The official purpose of this measure was to protect America from domestic traitors. In fact, only 10 people were convicted of spying for Japan during the war, and not one was of Japanese or Asian descent. Let me read this to you again. The official purpose of this measure was to protect America from domestic traitors. In fact, only 10 people were convicted of spying for Japan during the war, and not one was of Japanese or Asian descent. The persecution of Japanese Americans created an internal enemy to boost support for the war and prevent a unified anti-war movement. The persecution of American communists served a similar purpose during America's Cold War with Russia. U.S. wars in the Middle East demand the persecution of Arabs and Muslims in America. This has nothing to do with keeping America safe. When Timothy McVeigh bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, there was no mass roundup of white American veterans. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, right-wing individuals and groups have attempted at least 60 terrorist plots since then, including plans to bomb or burn government buildings, banks, refineries, utilities, clinics, synagogues, mosques, and bridges, to assassinate judges, politicians, and civil rights leaders, and to acquire machine guns, missiles, explosives, and biological and chemical weapons. The extent to which the mainstream media ignore white, homegrown terrorists is astonishing. Arabs and Muslims were targeted after 9/11 to build public support for Washington's plan to invade the Middle East. To promote paranoia, American airport security were warned that anyone from the Middle East could be a terrorist. It didn't take long for all brown-skinned people to be included. By 2004, Amnesty International reported, quote, "Racial profiling of citizens and visitors of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent and others who appear to be from those areas or members of the Muslim and Sikh faiths has substantially increased since September 11, 2001. Approximately 32 million Americans, a number equivalent to the population of Canada, reported they have already been victims of racial profiling," close quote. One U.S. airport official confiscated a bundle of cooking spices that my East Indian friend was bringing back from her visit home. She was told that the spices were a potential weapon that could be thrown in the pilot's eyes. From the ridiculous to the outrageous, people are being questioned, humiliated, detained, interrogated, strip-searched, imprisoned, deported, and tortured for the crime of having brown skin, being Arab, or being Muslim. President Bush responded to the increase in attacks against Arab-looking people by stating that all Arabs and Muslims are not enemies. But actions speak louder than words. The U.S. bombing of Iraq made no distinction between military and civilian, friend and foe. The state encouraged anti-Arab racism by imprisoning people on the suspicion of being terrorists, holding them without charge or access to legal counsel, and what the Justice Department later ruled were mentally and physically abusive conditions. The aim of such measures was to send the message that all Arabs and all Muslims are possible terrorists. Those who oppose state policies are also treated as enemies. Whoever is not with us is against us. In 2002, the Department of Justice launched Operation TIPS, Terrorism Information and Prevention System. The plan was to recruit, quote, a million letter carriers, meter readers, cable technicians, and other workers with access to private homes as informants to report to the Justice Department any activities they think suspicious, close quote. That same year, the Pentagon launched its own spy program, Total Information Awareness, TIA, to monitor all electronic transaction data in the United States and internationally. While Operation TIPS and TIA were officially dropped, domestic spying continues on a massive scale. Washington spends more than $40 billion a year to fund its spy agencies. FBI counterterrorism units monitor civil rights groups like the American Civil Liberties Union, peace groups like United for Peace and Justice, environmental organizations like Greenpeace, charities, churches, and thousands of individuals who have committed no crimes. War brings the iron fist of the state out of its velvet glove. Police attack anti-war demonstrators to show what happens to those who oppose the government. Under the Patriot Act, political dissenters can be charged with domestic terrorism and treated like terrorists. A man finds federal agents at his door to question his opposition to the war. A youngster is suspended from school for wearing a political T-shirt. Secret Service agents question a high school student about anti-war drawings he made in art class. The demand for conformity is expressed by the slogan, America, love it or leave it. Anyone who protests the loss of civil liberties is considered a traitor. As Attorney General John Ashcroft warned, to those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this, your tactics only aid terrorists, close quote. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Losing humanity. The strategy of divide and rule dehumanizes society by breaking human bonds and turning people against each other. It isn't easy to convince ordinary people to kill people just like them or to support such killing. The targeted population must be painted as less than human. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair defended the invasion of Iraq by insisting, quote, these people are not like us. They are not people who abide by the normal rules of human behavior, close quote. Perverse logic justifies brutalizing them on the basis that they are not as civilized as we are. The ordinary soldier gets the message. Photographs of U.S. and British soldiers torturing Iraqi prisoners show the victims with hoods over their heads, reduced to faceless objects. Writer Luc Santé observed, quote, the pictures from Abu Ghraib prison are trophy shots. The American soldiers included in them look exactly as if they were standing next to a gutted buck or a 10-foot marlin. There was something familiar about that jaunty insouciance, that unabashed triumph at having inflicted misery upon other humans. And then I remembered. The last time I had seen that conjunction of elements was in photographs of lynchings. Close quote. Every war comes home. Methods developed to subdue foreign populations are inevitably used domestically. As a military policeman in Vietnam, John Burge was trained to torture suspects. Back in America, he joined the Chicago Police Force and found a new use for his skills. In 1993, Burge was fired for supervising the systematic torture of more than 100 black men over a period of more than 20 years. 13 of these men had been sentenced to death on the basis of confessions obtained through beatings, burnings, suffocation, electric shock, and mock executions. A 2004 New York Times investigation found that prisoners in the United States were being treated much the same as prisoners in Iraq. This is no coincidence. Prison officials with experience torturing American inmates were selected to run Iraqi prisons and train Iraqi prison guards. Torturing prisoners is not an aberration, nor is it caused by a few bad apples. Those who profit by dominating others will do whatever is necessary to secure their power. The people at the top set the example by dehumanizing the enemy. General James Mattis, commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, was quoted as saying, quote, "It's fun to shoot some people." Admiral Harris, commander of the American prison at Guantanamo, told reporters that three prisoners being held without hopes of release had killed themselves because, quote, "They have no regard for life, neither ours nor their own," close quote. With leaders like these, it's no wonder that ordinary soldiers assault, torture, and murder. In an open letter to GIs in Iraq, Stan Goff describes his experience in Vietnam. "We had to dehumanize our victims before we did the things we did. We knew deep down that what we were doing was wrong. So they became dinks or gooks, just like the Iraqis are now transformed into ragheads or hajis. People had to be reduced to niggers here before they could be lynched. No difference. So long as they were human beings with the same intrinsic value we had as human beings, we were not allowed to burn their homes and barns, kill their animals, and sometimes even kill them. So we used these words, these new names, to reduce them, to strip them of their essential humanity." Close quote. Goff's warning to soldiers stands as a warning to us all. When you take away the humanity of another, you kill your own humanity. You attack your own soul because it is standing in the way. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Their gain, our pain. You tell me the truth. You tell me that my son died for oil. You tell me that my son died to make your friends rich. You tell me that my son died so you can spread the cancer of imperialism in the Middle East. You tell me that. Cindy Sheehan. In 1995, when 60 Minutes host Leslie Stahl asked Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, quote, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died because of the sanctions against Iraq. I mean, that is more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?" Albright replied, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price we think is worth it." 10 years later, President George W. Bush claimed that the mounting death toll in Iraq was worth it. Most parents of dead Iraqis and dead American soldiers would not agree. The elite reap the power and profit that are paid for with other people's lives and other people's suffering. It is commonly believed that ordinary Americans benefit from U.S. imperialism. This is not true. What the U.S. capitalist class takes from the poor people of the world does not trickle down to American workers. On the contrary, this surplus is invested in extracting more wealth from all workers, including those in the United States. When U.S. oil companies were reaping billions in oil profits from the war, ordinary Americans were paying record-high prices at the gas pumps. In no way does capitalism at home or imperialism abroad benefit ordinary workers. Workers' living standards rise and fall based on their willingness to fight the employers to keep more of what they produce. The living standard of American workers reached a peak back in the late 1960s as a result of class struggles. Conditions have deteriorated since, because workers have submitted to employers' demands for higher productivity and more profits. Capitalist competition is always waged at the workers' expense. On the economic front, each employer goads his employees to produce more and faster than his competitors' employees. The capitalist who can pressure his workers to give up the most surplus wins. The workers of the losing enterprise are laid off, and the workers of the winning enterprise have increased their own exploitation. I want to read that again because that is an amazing insight. Capitalist competition is always waged at the workers' expense. On the economic front, each employer goads his employees to produce more and faster than his competitors' employees. The capitalist who can pressure his workers to give up the most surplus wins. The workers of the losing enterprise are laid off, and the workers of the winning enterprise have increased their own exploitation. On the military front, each state goads its workers in uniform to fight harder and kill more people than the workers in uniform of the opposing state. Rulers who command the most brutal and destructive military forces win, while the workers of both nations lose, as the following examples reveal. In 2003, the U.S. launched its war against Iraq on the pretext of protecting America from further terrorist attacks. By 2004, the number of terrorist attacks reached a record high. In 2005, the number of terrorist attacks had more than tripled over the previous year. Attacks on military personnel were not included. The war on terror has made the world more dangerous. Washington refuses to admit this, and the State Department has stopped publishing the data. The primary beneficiary of the war against Iraq is the U.S. capitalist class, which has seized control of one of the world's richest sources of oil. American corporations have also reaped a windfall in war profits. The primary losers of the war are ordinary Iraqis and ordinary Americans. The U.S. tax dollars being spent to conquer Iraq represents a transfer of wealth from the American working class to a few wealthy U.S. corporations and individuals. The website of the National Priorities Project keeps a running total of how much money Congress is appropriating to wage the war in Iraq and what that money could provide in terms of medical care for America's uninsured children, public education, public housing, and stopping HIV/AIDS. The costs are broken down by state, by U.S. household, and by individual American. Every social issue in America today is linked with this war. When Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast, most of the Louisiana and Mississippi National Guard were deployed in Iraq, along with essential equipment like high water vehicles and refueling tankers and generators. A nearby army brigade from Fort Polk was not mobilized to help the flood victims because it was preparing to go to Afghanistan. By March 2006, Congress had appropriated more than $245 billion for the Iraq War, while hundreds of thousands of Americans displaced by Hurricane Katrina remained homeless. One anti-war demonstrator made the connection when she held up a sign. "No Iraqi left me on a roof to die." Whether they live in the invading or the invaded country, ordinary people pay for war with their blood. The people in power do not send their children to war. They send the children of the working class. By 2005, over 2,000 American soldiers had been killed in Iraq, and tens of thousands were disabled with horrible injuries. The proportion of U.S. soldiers in Iraq suffering from depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder is approaching the 1-in-3 ratio suffered by Vietnam veterans. Soldiers and their families get shabby treatment in return for their sacrifice. For months at a time, active duty soldiers are paid late or not at all. The General Accounting Office found the Defense Department's payroll system to be, quote, so primitive and error-prone that few people fully understand it, close quote. Many returning soldiers have lost their jobs, homes, and families. According to the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, nearly 200,000 veterans are homeless on any given night, and more than 500,000 are homeless over the course of a year. More than one out of every three homeless males in America is a veteran. While the military gets billions of dollars to develop new weapons, the Department of Veterans Affairs is starved of funds to treat the sick and wounded. The bombs produced in America leave behind toxic waste that pollutes our air, water, and food. Soldiers also bring the war home. During the 1991 Gulf War, Timothy McVeigh was ordered to kill surrendering Iraqi soldiers. 4 years later, he bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City. In October 2002, Gulf War veteran John Allen Muhammad went on a shooting rampage in Washington, D.C. that left 10 people dead. Other veterans have killed family members, strangers, and themselves. The war machine that turned these men into murderers is not put on trial. Soldiers and anti-war activists have a common interest. Both want to end the war and bring the troops home. The ruling class dreads such an alliance. The film Sir No Sir documents the scale and heroism of the soldiers' revolt that forced the U.S. defeat in Vietnam. To keep soldiers out of the anti-war movement, warmongers attack anti-war activists as traitors who despise their own soldiers and root for the enemy. They just as falsely portray all soldiers as gung-ho for war and hostile to the peace movement. The myth that anti-war activists spat on soldiers returning from Vietnam is pure PR. Vietnam veteran Jerry Lemke, author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, insists that stories of spat upon Vietnam veterans are bogus, close quote. The Veterans Administration commissioned a Harris poll in 1971 that found 94% of Vietnam veterans reporting friendly homecomings from their age group peers who had not served in the military. Moreover, the historical record is rich with the details of solidarity and mutuality between the anti-war movement and Vietnam veterans. The real truth, in other words, is that anti-war activists reached out to Vietnam veterans, and veterans joined the movement by large numbers. The benefits of unity. To prevent the majority from uniting against them, the capitalist class pits groups of people against each other, white against black, men against women, citizen against immigrant, Christian against Muslim, and so on. By fostering such competition, employers divide, rule, and profit. In a divided society, some people are better off than others, including within the working class. It is easier to be white than black, to be male than female, to be a citizen instead of an immigrant, to be heterosexual instead of homosexual, to be able instead of disabled, and so on. It can seem that those who are better off benefit from those who have it worse. This is the point of divisions, to keep ordinary folks so busy measuring whose crumb is bigger that nobody notices who ran off with the bakery. Of course, some crumbs are preferable to others. It is better to be educated than illiterate, to have a home than to be homeless, to have a job than to be unemployed, to be free than to be in prison. However, these differences are insignificant compared with the humongous difference created by class. In 1999, the world's 225 richest people had a combined wealth of $1 trillion. That's as much as the combined annual income of the world's 2.5 billion poorest people. The wealth of the world's three richest individuals is greater than the combined gross domestic product of the 48 poorest nations. If the height of the Washington Monument, 555 feet, represented the average income of the top 500 American CEOs, the average American worker's income would be 16 inches tall in comparison. Now that's a real difference. Talk of white privilege and male privilege makes it seem that all whites benefit from black oppression and that all men benefit from women's oppression. This outlook ignores the class divide and who really benefits. The Grand Canyon between the wealthy elite and everyone else is possible only because the majority is divided. Instead of fighting for crumbs, a united majority could take control of the world's wealth and share it. Those who argue that whites benefit from black oppression ignore the fact that no benefit from this division could possibly compare with what both could have if they pulled together. Consider the American South. The South remains the region where discrimination against blacks is most severe. The South is also the region where incomes of white workers are lowest and poverty amongst whites is highest, where the rights of labor, white and black, have been most trampled, where white trade union membership and influence have been most drastically curtailed. The capitalist class does benefit from oppression. The difference between the wages of higher-paid and lower-paid workers goes to the employers. The bosses also pocket the difference between what these workers make and how much they could make if they were not divided. Like Frederick Douglass said, they divide both to conquer each. By insisting that all men benefit from the oppression of women, feminist politics divides the working class. In reality, workers of both sexes are exploited and oppressed by capitalists of both sexes. During a strike, women workers understand that class comes first. They fight beside their male co-workers instead of seeking allies with their female employers or with the female relatives of their male employers. The power and privilege of upper-class women depend on the exploitation of male and female workers. In contrast, the oppression of women makes life more difficult for ordinary men. Women's lower wages pull down the family income. When women suffer, the men in their lives also suffer. Men whose wives have stressful jobs, unsupportive bosses, and few promotions are 7 times more likely to develop heart disease, regardless of the status of their own jobs. When women advance, the men in their lives benefit. Having a wife with more education lowers the husband's risk of smoking, being overweight, having high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, and dying of heart disease. Where social conditions are better for women, they are also better for men. One study examined the status of American women in all 50 states, measuring political participation, employment, wages, and reproductive rights. Expecting to find a link between better conditions for women and lower female death rates, researchers were surprised to find that, quote, strikingly, male mortality rates were even more strongly linked to the status of women than female death rates, suggesting that men are better off health-wise, where women's status is more equal to men's. The critical finding is that gender inequality has costs for men as well as women. In general, a society that tolerates greater gender inequalities is more likely to be less healthy for both men and women. There is strength in unity. The union movement has a saying, "United we stand, divided we fall." The belief that ordinary people benefit from imperialism, racism, sexism, and homophobia is just as mistaken as the belief that more police, more prisons, and more wars will keep us safe. Only the ruling class benefits from divisions that keep the majority subordinate. The next chapter explains how people are indoctrinated from childhood to accept the world as it is. Summary. The few can dominate the many only by dividing them, by minimizing similarities and magnifying differences. However, the differences between ordinary people are insignificant compared with the colossal chasm between the classes. The capitalist class profits from divide and rule, while ordinary people are prevented from working together to build a better life.